Our first speaker is Walter H. Andrus, Jr., the International Director of the Mutual UFO Network, Inc., MUFON, a worldwide organization dedicated to resolving the phenomenon known as unidentified flying objects. He also serves on the staff of their journal, the official publication. He works for a very famous electronics firm as in the products division. He's in a managerial position with them. He lives in Seguin, Texas. I think I pronounced that right. Seguin, Texas. All right. He lives in Seguin, Texas. He's a ham radio operator. For those of you who might follow the same course, W5VRN, holds an FCC first-class license, private pilot's license, an all-around guy. He's presented many lectures at colleges, universities, civic groups, all over the country. MUFON was formed in 1973, one of the very recent organizations, although there is some question as to whether it was 1973 or 1969. However, depends on which journal you read, I suppose. In any event, it's a real pleasure to present the Director of MUFON, Walt Andrus.
Thank you, Hal. It's a pleasure to address the group at UFO 79 and to correct Hal. The Center for UFO Studies started in Chicago in 1973. The Mutual UFO Network was organized in May of 1969. A new look at the UFO entity evidence. At MUFON, when we say entity, this includes all types of creatures and beings observed in, on, or near, or associated with UFOs. For this presentation, entities will be divided into four major categories. One, dwarf-like or small humanoids. Second, human-appearing beings comparable in size to ourselves. Three, animal-like creatures. And the fourth, robots. Physically, I'm talking about creatures that have a head, a body, two arms, two legs, and appendages that we might call hands and feet. This does not include biological cells or substances displayed in motion pictures like the alien, for instance. In order for us to take a new look at the entity evidence, it is essential that we review a few of the typical cases that have been investigated from the UFO literature. Since there are no known documented photographs of alien beings, we must rely upon an artist's rendition of the entities, the drawings prepared by the investigator, or the sketches made by the witnesses. We are indebted to the talented artists and investigators who have so diligently endeavored to predict and depict faithfully reproductions from the witnesses' verbal descriptions. After reviewing a few major cases, examples of the four categories of entities, I'll present some new unpublished cases and conclude with the latest information from Leonard A. Stringfield on the bodies in government custody, presently being examined by medical authorities. Witnesses' entity descriptions have been obtained by two basic methods. One, an interview of what was observed by the witness while entirely conscious with all of their normal sensing faculties. And second, descriptions obtained when the witness effectively relived the experience while under hypnotic regression techniques. With this introduction, let's proceed into the slide illustrated portion of this presentation. If we'll cut the lights and turn on the projector, please. This is an artist's rendition of a closer encounter of the third kind, can bring you up to date, because this is a usual lead-in to many, many UFO cases. We're going to break these into three distinct types. Type one would be the 3 to 5 foot dwarf or small build creature. This is a composite drawing done by Hal Crawford in Dallas, Texas. Type 2 is the 5'6" tall human. Human in appearance, we said, somewhat like ourselves. Type 3 is the animal type, sometimes considered chimpanzees, gorillas, the Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and so on. In order to give you an idea of the physical characteristics of these creatures we'll be looking at, we have the proportions here of a human, male and female, the proportion of the length of the arms, the trunk, the legs, and so on, because you'll find distinct variations as we proceed through some of the cases. This is simply a composite drawing done by a police officer in San Jose, California, as he visualized what creatures look like. Let's take the type 2 occupants first, the ones that are human appearance and in size. This goes back to the Cisco Grove, California case, or the bow and arrow case of September 1964, the experience of Don Shrum. Here we have a creature 5 feet tall with no apparent nose. The color of the suit is silver, had gloves. There's no detail of the feet noted. Had large dark eyes, like I said, welding glasses or goggles. This you recognize as the oil painting by Mike Rogers of the Travis Walton case that we'll go into briefly. This is the humanoid type creature that escorted Travis Walton out of the craft. This was all done through hypnotic regression, courtesy of Jim Harder, who's present, and I'm sure Leo Sprink was involved also. Here we have a being that Travis described under hypnosis as 6'2" tall, extremely muscular, appeared to weigh in excess of 200 pounds, had a tight-fitting bright blue suit of material that looked like soft velour. His feet were covered with black boots, and a black band or belt was wrapped around his middle. He carried no tools or weapons on his belt or in his hands. There was no insignia on his clothing. The dark complexion was like a deep, even tan, and he had no beard or mustache. Strange eyes bothered Travis, that they were bright golden hazel in color, and wearing a transparent helmet. There was no communication between Travis and this creature. This humanoid took Travis out of the craft and into, it looks like, a hangar, and over to another room where they were introduced and to two other men and a woman dressed very similar, except they had no helmets. This is a artist's conception of the Barty and Betty Hill case of September 19, 1961, as the beings are peering out of the craft at Barney. This is taken from John Fuller's book titled The Interrupted Journey. Looking at a close-up of one of those creatures, which also takes us to the bust that Marjorie Fish prepared from a description given to her by Betty Hill. This bust and entity was used as the sample for the entity in the motion picture Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Here's some pictures taken from the NBC film, The UFO Incident, where Barney is being escorted to the craft. We show them only because this, again, is the artist's idea of what the beings look like based on sketches and drawings. And Barney and Betty inside the craft, communicating with the leader. In the motion picture, Estell Parsons played Betty and Earl Ray Jones as Barney. Now you see Earl Ray Jones is on the TV program Paris. This is the leader as depicted in the motion picture. Now let's go into the type 3 occupants, which are very definitely animal variety. We said the Bigfoot, the Sasquatch, the Abominable Snowman. Some people consider these probably experimental animals because in our first space flights, we sent up chimpanzees, the Russians used dogs, and so on. Some cases we've been involved in, this is the famous Momo, the Missouri monster that was seen in Louisiana, Missouri on July 11, 1972, when Doris Harrison, age 15, and her brother Terry, age 8, saw this 7-foot-tall long, black, shaggy creature in their backyard. This is in the afternoon. It had long, dangling arms, but the feet were not visible when Doris saw the creature, due to grass and so on in front of it, and Terry didn't notice. And when I did the interview, it was Terry and Doris at this point. I made the picture, the drawing prior to this time, while interviewing the two children. On June 30th, just about a week and a half before that, this creature was seen going through Quiver River near Torrey, Missouri, in Quiver River State Park, witnessed by three adults, and one of the adult fishermen said, "Get a load of that hippie," as this creature came out of the water. Yes, they had long, shaggy black hair and being wet. This is a sketch that our MUFON staff artist Larry Hanna made when he and John Schuster, our deputy director, interviewed the three adults that had this sighting in Quiver River State Park. They didn't see the feet because at this point in time they were so well frightened that they wrapped the south bank. They were all through fishing and put the south bank, whereas the creature scrambled up the north bank of the river. This park is 30 miles from Louisiana, Missouri, so it was adequate time for this creature to move up the Mississippi River Valley from Torrey, Missouri to Louisiana, Missouri. These are the footprints that were left on the riverbank. They went back afterwards to make sketches. This is a composite drawing made by an artist for Stan Gordon, our MUFON state director for Pennsylvania. It's a composite drawing of 91 creature sightings made in Westmoreland County from June 1973 through February 1974. It has glowing red eyes, which aren't depicted here, a large nose, parrot ears, fang-like teeth, extremely long arms. They had both day and nighttime sightings in and near populated areas, even shopping centers. This is a kind of a unique character that was observed July 12, 1977, down in Puerto Rico between 8:30 and 9 o'clock in the evening by Senor Olmos. He said the object was 3.5 feet tall, wore a helmet with a clear glass front, dressed in a green garment. The Indian walked up to the streetlight post that was in their backyard. As did this, Senor Olmos, who is an amateur artist, asked his daughter to get a pad of paper and pencil so he could make a sketch of the creature. In looking for the pad, she turned on the outside light and turned, frightened the creature away. The creature retraced his steps down underneath a barbed wire fence, back out into a field. This is a farming community. It turned on some type of propulsion device on its back, and it could hear a humming sound like an electric drill. The object took off like Superman, went up 10 or 12 feet high, and flew 420 feet to the nearest row of trees and disappeared. We're in the area here of robots, because the last one we can't say whether it's a robot or a humanoid or an animal, because it had a tail which would give you the animal aspect. It had a uniform or a suit like a human. This is one of the creatures that chased Don Shrum up the tree up in Cisco Grove, California, during that case in September of 1964, the artist's concept. Again, looking at it closer, it had reddish-orange eyes that seemed to illuminate the face. The eyes definitely glowed in the dark. Had a square jaw and square shoulders, about 5 feet tall. Had a hood or helmet that came down to the shoulders. The suit was a clothing that looked like a dull metallic silver or platinum color. It had fingers like medieval armor gloves. That takes us to one of the more famous cases, the Pascagoula, Mississippi affair on October 11, 1973. When three robots floated out from this hovering craft to the pier where Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker were fishing. Again, fishermen. They estimated it was about 5 feet tall. This is a drawing that I made from the initial wire service reports from interviews. Dr. Harder is present this morning, and Dr. Hynek flew down immediately and interviewed Charlie Hickson and Calvin Parker in Pasco, Mississippi. The suit was kind of somewhat silver-gray in color with wrinkles or ribs, had claw or mitten hands. The initial report said crab claws, so that's why I drew that sketch. But then when we showed the drawing to Charlie Hickson at Fort Smith, he said it was more like mittens. In other words, they could do this, close the fingers to a thumb. We talked about pointed ears, and the first thing we thought of was Dr. Spock on Star Trek, but ears weren't pointed like that at all. They were probably sensing devices, or like antennas, two protruding out where ears might be on the head and one where the nose might be. They floated right across the water in the land area and did not walk. The legs stayed side by side. The feet looked more like elephant's feet or big rubber balls. This is a picture made by Jim Flint the next morning at the Walker Shipyards from the details given to him by Charles and Calvin. This is a sketch done for the National Enquirer and the Dick Cavett ABC TV show. It was an approved drawing, but looks very similar in nature. This is Charlie Hickson when we visit with him over at Fort Smith, Arkansas. You'll find him a very down-to-earth, collected individual. And what's interesting here is 45 years of age. This is a good example of why we select astronauts that are up in the 40-year category, because they're very stable, they think. Poor Calvin Parker fainted from fright during his experience and wasn't a very good witness. This is another case during the flap of 1973. This is the famous Falkville, Alabama object. We say object, creature, being, of October 70, 1973, made by Police Chief Jeff Grinhall. One of four photographs made. He claimed that this object was 6 feet tall and could run as fast as a car. Well, photo analysts find that this is really a human being in a fire-retardant fire suit with a foil wrapped around in numerous places to get reflections. So I'm afraid we'll have to call that one a hoax, but we show it for the humorous aspect. Let's go into what we call the Type 1 occupants, the small dwarf-like beings, because these people, this type of creature, predominates. One of the cases that's just received a lot of publicity lately is the Andreessen Affair, a book by Ray Fowler, who's our MUFON Director of Investigations. The entire investigation was conducted by MUFON people in Massachusetts. This is Betty Andreessen's rendition of the beings or creatures as they walked right through her kitchen door into her home, all in single file. So they moved in somewhat of a jerky motion, leaving a vapor image behind, and that's why she put the little shadow effect. This is the leader of his face as he peered in the kitchen. He said eyes were cloudy light. The left eye, she said she'd see the wrinkles, although you notice in the right eye. Said only the eye moved up, and it became slanted, somewhat upward, and this is how she depicted it moving. It had a gray, clay-like skin, wore a shiny, dark blue uniform with a blue banner across it, which we saw in the earlier pictures. It had holes for noses and ears, and some of the holes, and a fixed, scar-like mouth, just a little slit. The leader was about 4 feet tall and identified himself as Quazga. This is one of the entities in profile. It had large wraparound cat-like eyes. Three-digited hands were gloved. Each left sleeve was adorned with an emblem that resembled a bird with outstretched wings. They wore high shoes or boots. The leader stretched out his hand and Betty asked, "Do you want something to eat?" They merely nodded. She started to cook some meat and then received another mental impression, or mental telepathy, if you please. They said, "We cannot eat food unless it is burned." So Betty complied. She turned up the heat and started burning the meat to the astonishment of these creatures. And their answer to that was, "But that's not the kind of food we eat. Our food is tried by fire. Knowledge tried by fire. Do you have any food like that?"
Well, going back into Betty's basic religion prompted her to get the family Bible, which she did, and the leader made additional copies for his colleagues. That's a good trick. Christ did that once upon a time to feed the multitude. The leader did give Betty a little thin blue book with clear pages. These are the indices they were drawn in the examination room. Said the skin seemed a luminous white. Uniform was silver white with white gloves. The boots seemed to blend right into the uniform. The eyes seemed to move very slowly. In Kwasgoff's farewell, we've only just touched on brief bits out of the book, The Andreessen Affair. One eye was white and one was black. This is quite unique. He had two deep furrows above his eyes, which were very pronounced. They appeared as feelers, but could have been deep creases caused by his eyes widening. Kwasga was now wearing a silver suit, as were the two Indies that returned her to her home. As she left the craft in her own backyard, she took a middle position between two of her captors, because all of them would float again, like the case in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and Betty Andreessen floated also. They floated to the ground one at a time and proceeded toward the house in single file. This is only a brief encapsulation because we're concerned about the entities. Based on Betty's sketches, Fred Youngren and his daughter Faith constructed this three-dimensional model, or a mugshot, of the bust of Kwasga, the apparent leader of the entities who abducted Betty. Let's go back to the Travis Walton case of November 5, 1975, in Posse Sitgraves National Forest, 15 miles from Heber, Arizona. This is a sketch of what the humanoids reportedly looked like by Mike Rogers from the explanations given to him by Travis Walton. Mike is a very talented artist. And that's evident in the pictures from the Travis Walton book. When Travis woke up on this tabletop, he was in a miserable condition. When he sat up, the device had been placed across his chest, crashed to the floor, and you see it down the lower bottom. It had no wires, tubes connected to Travis or anything else. Greenish rays came from underneath the overturned machine, probably some type of device examining him. The fair-looking Indians were a little under 5 feet tall. Get an idea here from his proportions. They were humanoid, having two legs, two arms, and hands with five digits on each. Their bald heads were disproportionately large for the size of their bodies. They had bulging, oversized craniums, a small jaw structure, and an underdeveloped appearance to their features that was almost infantile. Their thin-lipped mouths were narrow, and Travis never saw them move. Lying close to their heads on either side were tiny wrinkled lobes, which were probably ears. Their miniature noses had small, oval nostrils. The incredible eyes were overdeveloped, and you see this over and over again in cases. People are just fascinated and really hypnotized by the penetrating eyes. The glistening brown orbs had irises twice the size of a normal human eye. I must commend Travis because in his book, he did a very fine job. We wonder first, who was his ghostwriter, because he does a very good job. But the young man is intelligent. The iris, or colored part of the eye, was nearly an inch in diameter. The iris was so large that even parts of the pupil were hidden by the lids, giving them the eyes of a, giving them the appearance of a cat-like appearance. There was very little of the white of the eye that could be seen. They had no eyelashes or no eyebrows. The huge lids, and this is where Travis is doing a real fine job, slid quickly down over the glassy bubbles of their eyes, then flipped open again like the release of roll-up window shades. And I can see some of the ladies in here using that same idea to describe them. The huge, moist, lichenous eyes and the milky translucence of their skin made their appearance seem slightly reminiscent of a cave salamander. The overall look was somewhat like that of a human fetus. Their frail bodies seemed to have thin bones covered with a white marshmallow-looking flesh. Travis touched one of them when he got up from the table, swung at one. He said it felt soft through the cloth of its garment. The muscles of its puny physique yield with a sponginess that was more like fat than sinew. Creatures were very light in weight. How heavy, he had no idea. They were all dressed in a single-piece coverall-type suit, which seemed to be made of soft, suede-like material of an orangish-brown color without texture or seams. There were no buttons, zippers, or snaps that were visible to Travis. The loose, billowy garments were gathered at the waist and perhaps at the ankles. They had no belts around their waist or collars at their neck. They wore a simplish pinkish tan footwear and so on. The skin was so pale it looked chalky, and we have it shown very white here. Compared to Travis's skin color, the humanoids had an ivory color. Let's go on to some other cases. This one occurred somewhat the same area, but way back in 1954, when Thomas Edwards had a sighting on U.S. Highway 66 near the New Mexico-Arizona border. He had crossed over into Mexico. He was driving from Long Beach, California to Louisiana to attend his uncle's funeral. He was a chief in the U.S. Navy, stationed in Long Beach at the time. He drove that evening until they got sleepy and pulled his Lane Continental off the side of U.S. 66. He had a hitchhiker in the front seat, a sailor that curled up in the front seat, went to sleep. Tom Edwards got in the back seat. He's 6'4", needed a little more space, and went to sleep. About 11 o'clock, he checked his watch. Someone tapped on his window and shone a light into the side window of his Lincoln Continental, woke him up. And he thought at first it was a New Mexico State Patrolman on a motorcycle because he had a uniform, but a helmet that looked like a motorcycle cop. When he stepped out of the car, he found that this creature was only about 5 feet tall, and when we measured it, was exactly 5 feet tall, because when Tom Edwards stands up, he's 6'4", and this is the creature hidden right here under his arm, and that's exactly 5 foot when we measured it. He was invited out of the car, and here was a craft hovering just off the highway. When he was inside, he said it measured between 450 and 500 feet in diameter. He was invited over to the craft. The only thing he could see, now it was dark, was looked like a real thick leading edge of a, let's say, a jetliner, because that's the only portion he could see in the dark. It had a trap door with stairways that extended down out of the bottom of it. When he walked over to it, there was a blue light being emitted from this opening, and they walked over to it, and as he approached it and walked into the blue light, he smelt something that smelled like burnt feathers or hair. And he probably doesn't know the significance of that, but chances are he was being sterilized at that moment. I quizzed him, when you took your first bath after your trip home to Louisiana, did you notice the hair in your body? He said, well, I didn't notice, and as soon as I got there, I slept, and he hadn't bathed in 2 days, so he couldn't give us anything solid on that aspect. When he went aboard the craft, they found 7 other creatures just like this aboard the craft. Each one had a control console, each one dressed exactly alike. The nose was very flat. The eyes were getting the wraparound effect, clear back to where the helmet left off. Had very thin lips and an olive complexion. Notice the pattern that goes through each of these cases. Hands had 5 long, thin fingers, very long in nature, and he said very narrow palms. He didn't notice any fingernails, but he thought he saw hair on the back of the fingers, which I say thought because this doesn't follow a pattern. However, pattern or no pattern, we want to know, what did that person see? This is a picture of Tom Edwards during the interview. And yes, he is a big man. He works for Southwest Bell Telephone Company, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, as a switchboard technician. We have a 2-hour tape interview, and of course too extensive to discuss at this time. A real fast case is still investigation back in California, since we're here in San Diego, up in Happy Camp, California. I know Paul Surrey's been up there many times. Jim Harder has been to visit there. This is a close encounter of the third kind that occurred in June of this year by Jane and Clint Chapin at their mine. This is a front view, a sketch of what they saw. And this is the back view as this creature went back to the craft. And Clint and Jane have lovingly called this fellow Charlie. Now we go to a brand new case that has never received any publicity. In Berryville, Arkansas, March of 1973. Mrs. Joan George was out pruning the apple trees in her orchard behind her home against the wishes of her husband, who was in business down in Houston, Texas at the time. And she's the person that will remodel her home and do anything that a man can do, she'll try to do. She's on top of this three-legged ladder, and of course it's probably the most dangerous type of ladder to get on. Two normal steps and one support. The ladder fell, and the ladder fell on top of her and injured her very seriously. Here she was lying in the orchard all by herself with the ladder across her that she couldn't move when two small hippie-apparent beings came walking through, or I should say gliding through the orchard up to her. She was lying there with blood-soaked slacks because her left thigh was injured very seriously at a 4-inch gash. When the creatures got closer to her, this is Indian number one, we'll call it, she noticed they were not hippies, but two very unusual appearing beings. Both Indies had identical shaped heads, long, narrow, and facial details. However, they were dressed entirely different. Each had black piercing eyes that wrapped around their heads under a heavy protruding brow. It comes back over and over again, doesn't it? Two nostrils observed with practically no nose protrusion and a narrow slit where a mouth would be. Notice the profile down here, there's hardly any nose whatsoever. Indian number one was 4 feet tall or less and probably weighed only 75 pounds by our standards, with a very frail, skinny body. Long, slim arm, had hands with four unusually long, thin fingers. She didn't note any thumbs on either entity. When Joan touched the hand of entity number one, it felt rough like sandpaper or dried leather and was intensely cold like a dead person. Entity number one wore a blue-gray, tight-fitting one-piece suit like double-knit material and had a tight-fitting blue-green head covering. That helmet seemed like a skull cap. Both entities had very small feet and wore soft boots that looked like tan gray suede. Their proportionally short legs had no defined knees and did not bend when the entities moved. Both creatures floated instead of walking and skimmed over the ground in the orchard without disturbing the grass. They left no traces of footprints in the orchard. Entity number two, the Berryville, Arkansas case, March 1973. And number two had identical facial features and a gray-brown complexion. However, his face is wrinkled like a prune. Joan George is 5 feet, 5 inches tall, whereas Indy number two is approximately 3 foot, 9 inches, and probably weighed, about 50 pounds. The one-piece suit worn by Indy number two was uniquely different from number one. It was composed of a continuous series of thin tire inner tubes, appearing bands covering the entire body. This is the best we could depict those. Whenever this entity bent over, as it did when it helped remove the ladder from across Joan's body, the tube shapes would flatten out across its back. And yes, the two were able to move the ladder off of her body with difficulty. The tube sections separated the elbows when the arms were bent. Entity number two sounded like a voice of an 8-year-old boy when it spoke to Joan. The sun had just set. The visibility was still very good. However, she could see a self-illumination emanating from the midsection of entity number two. Entity number one seemed to be the leader and carried on the majority of the conversation, brief as it was. Probably by mental telepathy, since the lips did not move and she said she could hear the sounds in her head. The voice of this one was more high-pitched like a woman, but with a very pleasant and beautiful sound. It seemed to have a mechanical sound, a little bit like a radio tuned to off the side of a broadcast station, giving kind of a lisp sound. The communications between Mrs. George and N number one are very significant to people thoroughly conversant with close encounters of the third kind. However, to Mrs. George, they were very confusing, since she was not a student of UFOlogy. After removing the ladder from her body, the entity told her to get up. She pointed to her left thigh and the blood-soaked slacks, explaining that she couldn't get up since her leg could have been broken.
Joan, prior to marriage, was a practicing registered nurse, so she was very concerned. She was told to try to get up, because she could get up if she tried. She regained her feet without any assistance from the entities. At this point in time, she felt very grateful to them for possibly saving her life, since she could have bled to death lying in the orchard while her husband was in Houston, Texas on business. Since the creatures were so frail and skinny, Joan invited them to come into her home for a meal. And Joan has never seen the Andreessen affair. She has now, but this happened in 73. Entity number one said, "We cannot eat food, only juice." As Joan was thinking to herself about what kinds of juice she had in her refrigerator, orange, had orange juice and tomato juice, and what types of juice she'd canned from her orchard, the entity number one seemed to read her mind and responded before she was able to even answer, and said, "Not that kind of juice." Since she couldn't be a hostess to her guests, she inquired whether she would ever see them again. Entity number one said it was very unlikely, since they did not trade in this very area very often. I asked Mrs. George to repeat this statement during my first tape record interview with her because it could relate to the Betty Hill star map with its trade routes. This stumped Joan because trade didn't mean anything to her until I gave her a copy of the Zeta Reticuli incident and explained about the trade routes as Betty Hill had depicted them in the map. Before leaving, entity number one gave Joan George a metal medallion as some sort of remembrance of this occasion. It was at this point that she felt the entity's rough fingers. She's touch creatures, and she is not under hypnosis, perfectly conscious. The entities then glide out of the orchard as dusk was drawing near, and Joan walked back to her home, which joined the orchard with her keepsake medallion. Even though she was a registered nurse, she did not seek medical help, since her leg healed within 4 days. She still has a 4-inch long scar, which is very visible in her upper thigh. During the height of the 1973 UFO flap, Joan had another sighting in Berryville, Arkansas, which was quite interesting. She isn't positive whether this is September 29th or 30th. It was definitely after dark, about 9 p.m. or later. Joan's husband had gone to bed, which he still does, quite early. Before retiring herself, she went out in the backyard to look for what she calls her dumb dog, because it didn't come home that evening. And after calling it and so forth and out through the orchard, couldn't raise the dog. At this point in time, she saw a fiery object proceeding toward the ground, looked like an airplane of fire, and started running across the golf course, which municipal golf course adjoins their orchard in Berryville, Arkansas, in the direction where she thought this object might come down. I say, as a former nurse, she felt maybe she could assist the victims of the airplane crash. After damaging her clothing and getting scratched going through a wild rose hedge at the edge of the golf course, she saw this large bowl-shaped object sitting in an opening between the bushes directly in front of her and a clump of hickory and maple trees directly behind it. The specific location adjoins the sewage disposal plant in Berryville, Arkansas. The visibility was somewhat limited due to broken clouds obstructing the moon as they moved. The majority of the illumination came from the white circular ring at the bottom of the craft. A little red glow and an area of green glow was visible between the rib sections on the top of the vehicle. Standing in front of the craft and about 30 feet from Mrs. George, she saw two entities, one about 5 feet tall and the second about 3 feet. At first she thought it was a mother and a child, but there were no fine physical characteristics. Entity number three, we'll call, was the larger one there. She could not distinguish a mouth or nose on the taller entity and was not sure about this feature on the small being due to the fact the illumination was all coming from behind the creatures. Their feet were not visible due to the bushes. Joan became very disturbed when she saw what she thought was blood dripping from under the tight-fitting helmet to the shoulder of the taller entity. Entity number three wore a one-piece suit like coveralls or a jumpsuit. Entity number four was that small being. J- Joan has no children of her own, but she has a mighty soft spot in her heart for children and even small animals that she adopts, cats and dogs that come by her home. It appears that the taller Indian had been injured when she saw what she thought had been blood dripping down the shoulder. She said Indian number 4 was exceedingly small and very frail, had kind of a pasty white complexion, best she could tell. Her first reaction was to call to the Indies, "I'll go get help," because she thought they'd been injured. After retracing her steps back through the rose bushes, across the golf course, back to the orchard and to her home, she came back in quite a disheveled condition, said her clothing had been torn, she'd lost her shoes in the mud, her hair was disarrayed, and she said, "I was a mess." Her husband, meantime, had woken up, reached over like this, and no Joan. So he went outside and started calling for her, checked the buildings on the farm. Well, it's not a real farm, small one. And when he couldn't find her, he went back in desperation, called the county sheriff in Berryville, Arkansas. He responded along with the Arkansas State Patrolman. They had just arrived as Joan rushed up to the backyard, and she thought she was in like Flynn, so to speak, because here's help. The sheriff of the county and a state patrolman to come help these people. But this is where she had another traumatic experience that would shake up anyone, because when she came up and asked for help and told the sheriff what she had seen, the sheriff only had one comment: "Lady, you're crazy. I'll give you two alternatives. We'll lock you up in the county jail, or I'll take you to Little Rock, Arkansas, to the Arkansas State Hospital." And the state patrolman and Randall, her husband, were kind of dumbfounded when the sheriff put her in the patrol car, didn't take her to the county jail. He drove her for 5 hours all the way to Little Rock, Arkansas, and had her committed, believe it or not, to the hospital. The next morning, by accident and good fortune for Joanne, the Dr. Elizabeth D. Fletcher, chief of staff of the hospital at that time, was serving as the admission doctor, since the regular doctor wasn't there. And when Joan was brought in, and Dr. Fletcher asked, "What are you doing here?" And she gave her a brief explanation and shook her head, and this was real amazing. She said, "You don't belong here." And the doctor gave her the keys to her apartment. "You said, you stay over in my apartment while we run our tests." 5 days later, after 32 doctors of examination, she's released, perfectly okay, allowed to go home. So this is what happens to some of the small-town sheriffs, for instance, what they will pull and make it very, very difficult for people that do report sightings. Needless to say, Sheriff Preet wasn't reelected, and Bob Pratt, who's here, has been dealing with the Berryville Sheriff's Department since then, and so we have a very cooperative sheriff in Berryville, Arkansas now, which is good. When Joanne goes back and recounts the experience, she gets to this point talking about these beings and the blood and rushing back to help them, and she breaks into tears. We had to simply stop because she feels like she failed these people. She went, told them she'd get them help, and when she tried to get help, all she got was being locked up in the state hospital. So if you remember the dates we said, right during the flap of 1973, Ted Blocher was real helpful in our co-chairman of our humanoid study group for MUFON, and he had newspaper clippings taken from newspapers at each adjoining county, the night of September 29th and night of September 30th. UFO abductees over the years have endeavored to take artifacts or have souvenirs to show what they had taken back from the craft. If you remember, Betty Hill had a book and they retracted, confiscated from her. In the case of Betty Andreessen, she had this small book that she had for about 5 days, and it too was confiscated. But Joan George, her case to me is much stronger because she still has her medallion. And if you remember, none of this was done under hypnotic regression. She has this medallion that was given to her by an entity, number 1. She treats it like a good luck charm and carries it with her wherever she goes. So there's nothing highly unusual about the rusty appearing like cast metal medallion. which she in the meantime has accidentally broken in two. It'll fit in the palm of your hand. This is Joan George when we recently interviewed her at our MUFON office in Seguin, Texas. But let's go back to that medal. Right now, I said she carries it as a keepsake, and she has agreed to allow us to take it to a laboratory, and we plan to go to Southwest Research in San Antonio and have the metal analyzed, determine if there's anything about its composition and crystalline structure that might make it extraterrestrial in origin. I say at this point in time, we can't get excited, but she does have a souvenir of her experience. This picture is quite unique. This is an artist's rendition of the sketch made by Grace O'Mara of one of the 4-foot-tall entities that she remembered under hypnotic regression as administered by Gene Richards in the San Francisco area. Each of the 4 frail, identically appearing beings allegedly abducted Grace while up in the mountains near Iowa Hills, California, in August 1974. Grace had a 4-hour time lapse. Grace shared her experience with the attendees at the recent MUFON UFO Symposium in San Francisco on July 7th, accompanied by the hypnotist, Mrs. Jean Richards. She also appeared on the November 7th edition of the NBC TV program, Real People, with this drawing when NBC filmed our symposium. This is a sketch that Leonard Stringfield made a year ago when he spoke to our 1978 symposium in Dayton, Ohio, of the long fingers, web-type hands on the creatures. We're going to take the privilege here of reading this. This is a rendition of the drawing of the creatures that are being examined at the present time in a medical facility by a doctor. Now, Leonard Stringfield's in direct contact with this doctor. They send the sketches back and forth, and they keep touching it up. I said this is composite information. We'll wrap up with this presentation. Concerning the general physiological description of the recovered alien humanoid from various sources follows, and we'll read. The approximate height is 3.5 to 4.5 feet tall, weight about 40 pounds. They have 2 round eyes without pupils, described as appearing mongoloid under a heavy brow. The head is large by human standards, almost a third of the entire body's size. The head is without ears or nose, and the mouth appears as a slit between lips. There are no teeth. The head and body is hairless. Hands of one type have 4 fingers, no thumb, and with a slight webbing effect. One type is also described as having no toes, showing evolutionary regression. The skin is not green, generally described as gray or ashen in color. In 2 known instances, the body is described as brown from charring, and this you've read in publications. The texture described by a medical doctor involved in the autopsy as reptilian and mobile over smooth muscle. Sounds a little bit like the Travis Walton case, doesn't it? There are no reproductive organs, no genitalia. Most observers note that where more than one body is retrieved, that all the heads appear similar. No information from any source about the brain is now presently available from this doctor. A colorless liquid is prevalent in the body without red cells. No food or water intake is known. They have no digestive system or GI tract. This is why they told Joan George, we can't eat, we can't take juice. More than one humanoid type is known. The lifespan is unknown. Certain characteristics of the body and limbs indicate trophy. In other words, kind of arrested development or not fully developed. Leonard is going to put this whole case together in his monograph titled The UFO Crash Retrieval Syndrome, to be published by the Mutual UFO Network. And in it, he will reveal a letter from the doctor alleging that he performed an autopsy on a humanoid. It describes his finding in more specific detail. We're going to wrap this right up here because this is our story on the entities. And yes, even in Texas, you can have your own license plates. And it's kind of novel. Instead of having my amateur call letters, we have MUFON, Seguin, Texas. And we do have a California plate with MUFON also that met the gentleman in San Francisco.
Thank you very much.